Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
All right, hello, hello, and welcome to Infinite Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton. Today we're broadcasting a show that was taped last week. At the conclusion of the show, there's going to be a piece with Ken DeHart, Master Professional, talking about his use of the Pocket Radar, so make sure you stay tuned for that. We are pleased to have Pocket Radar as a sponsor of the show, and on August 10th, we're going to be giving away a free Pocket Radar, $199 value there. So definitely you're going to want to be in the running for that, so listen for the clues. We're not going to make it very easy on you, but you will have a chance to win by paying attention. This week, using the Pocket Radar, I was easily able to see that one of my players had become overly fatigued by the fairly dramatic drop in ball speed, but I was able to show that to him using the Pocket Radar. So that was a great thing. We were able to talk about what to do if your ball speed happens to change during a match. If you're not hitting the ball as hard as you want to, it's not coming back. So you got to make an adjustment at that time. All right. So we're going to go on to our show here featuring Joel Drucker. And he has some great things to say about player development, some very keen insights, and a unique and true perspective on that. So here we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Infinite Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton, and this is going to be an exciting show, everybody, because we've got Joel Drucker on the show, and he is a fantastic writer and has quite a bit of energy and some great topics that he would like to discuss on the show today, some that I think will be somewhat controversial and very challenging to anyone who's really a stakeholder in tennis. So I'm extremely excited to be able to have this conversation, and I know that he and I will have some back and forth and some debate, as well as kind of like getting a little deeper into these topics. So we're going to talk a lot about player development, how coaches and players, how coaches and parents sell out their players. Pretty interesting topic there. And then also, what ought to be the cornerstones of tennis education? Well, we're going to get into Joel's career as a journalist and talk about the importance of that for the growth of tennis. So it's going to be a great show, and we're going to have a commercial, and then I'm going to call Joel right in, and we're going to get arguing as best we can. Here we go.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
All right, welcome back. Hey, Joel, are you there?
I'm here, Bill. Good to be with you.
Okay. Hey, do you remember how we met?
Yes, I do. I do exactly. You ran a tournament that I played.
To my memory.
I'm sorry, what?
Let's talk about how you and I met and some of our funny little things that have happened. Do you remember how that all went down?
I remember exactly how it went. I'm staring at the physical object for it right now. You were running a 4-5 tournament I played in Hayward, California, and you were the tournament director, and I entered the tournament. It was a 3-day tournament, a Saturday, Sunday, Monday. I won 2 matches on a Saturday. I won 2 matches on a Sunday, and there I was in the finals. And I had the Monday was Martin Luther King Day. I had a holiday. Hoped to play the final another day. And you said the rules were that you couldn't play the final another day, so I had to default the final.
Bummer. But you ran a fair and honest
tournament.
That you and I were at a tournament and we were warming up in the parking lot.
Which tournament was that?
I really had a fun time talking with you and hitting in the parking lot at a high school. So
you and I had a buck for every minute we ever spent at a high school or a Cal State campus hitting tennis balls. We'd be pretty rich, huh?
Exactly. All right. So let's talk a little bit about your journalism career because obviously you had to go through a process to get there. And my cat is busy going berserk here, but you go ahead and talk about that, and I'll take care of my cat. How did you get started in the journalism business?
Well, I thought in tennis journalism is kind of interesting. I went to college. I went to Berkeley thinking I was going to be a lawyer, and by my sophomore year, I decided I wanted to be a writer, and I was going to write about culture and politics and other topics. And I worked on a humor magazine in college, and somehow late in my senior year, just before I was going to go to Washington, D.C. and work at a political publication, I had a chance to write for this local publication in the Bay Area we both know called Inside Tennis. And I wrote several stories for Inside Tennis. I wrote a satire story about tennis that was kind of like the movie Body Heat, except set in a tennis setting in Marin County. And then I covered a tournament at the club I play at now, the Berkeley Tennis Club. And I think in the course of that, I saw that tennis and me were kind of meant for each other. Tennis was kind of the girl next door. That was the one I was meant to love all along. And I'd grown up playing. I'd played a lot of junior tennis from the age of about 13 on, growing up in Southern California. I'd followed the game. I'd taught tennis during summers in college. But I only sort of thought of a way I could have a kind of a life and a career in tennis. And I hadn't really given that serious thought. And then that time when I was covering a tournament in 1982, it hit me. There it was. And then at the same time, Bill, it took a while for me to get that to more of a full-time position. I spent 10 years working for several large public relations firms that had nothing to do with tennis. And actually, I think that was helpful. It was really helpful for me to spend time away from tennis to learn a skill, to learn more about writing and communications, and to get out of it and really hone my craft more as a writer. So then I could come back to when I started freelancing more full time in 1993. I could really bring my skill to it, which is something different than just being in tennis the whole time.
So you would say so? It took you about 10 years for it to become something where you could do that full time.
Well, full time, but I've since 1993 I've been working for myself, and in those 20 years, tennis has been a significant part of it. and more so. And there are other things I do too. There are other things I write about. There are other worlds of communications I consult in. So, but tennis more and more so. So it's been kind of a gradual thing, and there are multiple things I do. I think the advice for people who want to be in it is that I always say to them, you need to be in tennis more than you think of breaking in or a specific thing. And so I tell people who want to write about it, I say, go write a story about something right in your backyard. Go do a story on the park where everyone hangs out, on the woman who just won her first tournament at the age of 78. Go dig out that kind of story, and that's going to prove what kind of craftsmanship you have, far more than just sitting in your basement writing a blog about Roger Federer.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because I actually wrote a piece on Roger Federer that was fairly well received, and that was pretty much the beginning and ending of my writing career. But Matt Cronin made the point that he thinks that tennis journalism is a very important part of the growth of the sport. So what are your thoughts on that?
I agree with that. I think it's important, though, for journalists to understand that their job is not to promote the sport, and people who interact with journalists, my job isn't to promote the sport. My job is to engage with the sport. And by dint of engaging, hopefully I will engage others in it. But my job is not to promote this. My job, I'm not the advertising agency for tennis. I'm not the marketing firm for tennis. But Matt is spot on. Obviously, editorial coverage and what people read and how people think about it helps people get engaged in the sport. And I work, as Matt does, in multiple mediums, in television, in print, and the Internet. And all of these ways trigger ways for fans to engage with the sport. However, it's not a primary the promoting the sport is not the primary goal or role of a journalist. That is not the primary role.
I think his point more was that we need more journalists to create more exposure for and more opportunities for that engagement.
Need is a function of economic demand. So if people want to read more, there'll be more need more.
Sure.
What the world needs, hey, the world needs love. You know, I mean, you can't just sire that into being and can't decree it. It has to kind of emerge, and the marketplace speaks. And sadly, it's only personally sad, but it's just soberly true, is that there isn't that much of a demand. People don't care to read that much about tennis. I know this when I wrote a book. I know this when I go to bookstores. I know this when I talk to publishers. I know this when I look at magazines. The tennis player, and maybe you know this also as a teaching pro, the tennis player is much more outcome than process focused. Golfers read. Golfers study. Golfers want to improve. Tennis players want to win.
Yeah, that's interesting. So that's a great you gave me a great leaping off point for the next topic, because we want to get into new ways to talk about player development. So, you know, I think that one thing people have to understand about you, Joel, is that you go all over the world and you meet, you know, all the greatest players from around the world, and you know, all the coaches, and you've seen all the different ways that players are brought up. And so I know you have some concerns about that. So let's get into the player development. What do you think needs to be done that's new?
Well, to me, as you know, I've had this talk, and it's been wonderful talking about it, is that we need to focus more on process more than outcome, and we need to focus on teachers creating the best possible player, equipping them with a wide range of tennis skills.
Let me interject there for a second. Flesh out what you mean by process instead of outcome.
Well, I think people look at the measure of a program by its results rather than what occurs to help make people better. If you and I were starting a program to teach kids how to write better, we wouldn't evaluate it by how many of them were publishing stories. We'd evaluate it by, are they reading? Are they writing? Are they writing more papers? How do they feel about what they're doing? We wouldn't just say, wow, three of them got published in the New York Times. We must be doing well. And tennis, by dint of being a competitive sport, there tends to be a lot of focus from parents and coaches of kids of very young ages on, oh, they're ranked. They must be doing well. We got three kids in our program are ranked now. They're in the. They must be doing well. And that doesn't have anything to do necessarily what they're doing. Yeah, are they competing? Are they winning matches? Yes. Are they learning the broadest set of skills? I don't know about that. I don't know about that any more than I know the fact that that kids at a ritzy prep school are getting good grades and SAT scores. That doesn't necessarily mean they're learning. That means
right. They're
engaging with the material in a way that helps them get a result. But I think the biggest crime in our tennis thing, and you talked about this in the opening, is that parents and coaches sell out their kids. The kids generate some reasonable results by the time they can be 9, 10, or 11. And from there, the skill set narrows rather than broadens. You know, let's work with what he's got. Let's not make him work on his volley more. Let's only go to workouts where we hit ground strokes. Let's not play practice sets. On and on and on. I think it's just a black plague that has infected the way the culture of the game exists.
Yeah. You know, I think the number one thing that I see that concerns me is the number of players who get to be about 16 or 17, and they either have chronic injuries in their low back or shoulder or some other, or they're just not enjoying it anymore.
They've only learned seven letters of the alphabet. They're like bad Russian players. They're like Elena Dementieva without the skill. What they have is some pretty good ground strokes, and maybe if they're a boy, they have a kick serve, and no one taught them how to volley, really. They hardly practice overheads. They never learned. I'm not saying they have to become Patrick Rafter and chip and charge all the time, but there's a lot of the broadest literature of the game that they weren't exposed to. And why is that the case? Because then when they were 11, they were winning from the baseline. They had their two-handed backhand and their topspin forehand, and presto, they were doing pretty well.
Yeah.
The coach knows better. The coach knows there's this world called volleying, but the coach has got the parent saying, hey, I want my kid doing well. And I always say to a parent, I say, gee, I was number 3 in fractions. I was really good at fractions. But when my teacher started having me do algebra, my mommy didn't call the teacher and say, ooh, he's not doing as well in algebra. Let him just do fractions. But that's what we have in tennis. We have a lot of kids who learn to do fractions. And very few teachers and parents have the guts to say, all right, let's continue. Let's learn algebra.
That's a great point, and I want to go a little further into that. We're going to go do one more commercial so that we can kind of get that out of the way do our good stuff for Nike here. So we're going to do that. We're going to come back. I have a little something to share with you, and then we'll get your reactions to that. Here we go.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
Okay, so we're back. So let me lay something on you, Joel, here, and it's going to be a little detailed description here. One of the things that was both a blessing and a curse was when we had our SAP open here, Bill Rapp, pretty much always had an open door for the American players. So we got to see the up-and-coming and the promising Americans here in San Jose. So there'd be 6 or 8 in a 28 draw. And so that was nice. But the observation that I would make with my friends as we're sitting there is you look at the Americans versus people from anywhere else, and how do they play? Either they have a big serve and a big forehand, and if they haven't won the point by the third shot, then there's no plan B. Or they're a gym rat, and they are in fantastic shape, and they run around and hit heavy topspin all day long, and they'll make 12 shots, and if they can win a 10-shot or more rally and grind the guy down, then they can win, but they also don't have plan B. You know, meanwhile, I watch, you know, players from any other country hit the slice backhand low to the two-hander and get him in a world of hurt, or not serve to the forehand, et cetera, and playing smart and using variety of shot. So that's my observation. How valid is that? What needs to be filled in? Where are we missing the boat?
I'm not going to go we Americans, because I've seen plenty of monochromatic players from all around the world too. And in a way, my dilemma isn't with players who have already kind of made it to the show, because in a way, you know, whether you're Michael Russell or whether you're Sam Querrey or John Isner, in a way the die is cast. And like I said, I don't think it's a we're missing the boat. I think it's a whole broader way. It's not going to happen when the player is 16 that he's going to learn that slice backhand. That's the problem. See, that's the problem. By the time he's 16, a good deal of his game is formed, oddly enough, particularly if he's good, because he's climbed a lot of mountains and he's part of the American thing. It has to do with how we define it. And I think another thing is, if any activity should transcend borders, it should be a sport for individuals. And I wish player development tennis had nothing to do with nations. I mean, look, Andy Murray, he's born in Scotland, England, Spain, Florida, goes around the world. What's he a product of? Tommy Haas, Germany, Florida, plays all around the world from the age of 11. What's he a product of? You know, tennis players aren't built indigenously into a nation, into a place. I know some of the Americans you saw in San Jose. I mean, there are other Americans. You know, hey, look, Pete Sampras had some pretty good variety of his game. You know, I mean, three other guys of his generation were Hall of Fame players. So I'm not so much quibbling with that as much as how we approach tennis culturally in a broader kind of way. I like, for example, Spain and France have this paradox. France has a lot of form but not as much function. Spain has a lot of function, but that's a certain kind of game, and it's done very well, but it's only one certain type of game, just like Sweden had its time and Russian women. And if you took away Nadal, and I know that's a strange thing to say, the Spain resume would match like a lot of the Russian women. A solid game that's made its mark on the pro game, but you don't just emulate other countries. You know, I was joking with my tennis channel, Jim Curry, at Wimbledon when we saw two Polish men in the quarters and Radwanska in the semis. So, oh, let's go to Poland, study how they do player development. Oh, look, they build courts behind churches. Great, let's do that. I mean, there's all this you know, you don't just study what another nation does and then seek to do it. I don't think it works that way. I think it has a lot more to do with what tennis's role is in the culture and how parents and coaches view the sport and the fact that we're a very comfortable country. My belief is the next great American player, he may not even be born, or she might be the daughter of an Iraqi immigrant. If you really look at the most important factor in player development in the history of tennis in the last 40 years was Joseph Stalin laying Eastern Europe to waste. That, to me, is the most important reason more players have come out of Eastern Europe than any part of the world. No middle class, no shopping centers, no comfort, just a lot of hell-driven people who were irrational enough to think tennis was going to be the way to get over that wall.
Well, yeah, there's no accounting for how much hunger can be built into people that way. And, you know, and then look at Serbia and Croatia and all that, and how, you know, people are trying to escape from that at the same time as also playing tennis. But I think also when faced with severe conditions and tragedy, I think also they also have a greater appreciation for the good things that come their way because of the hard work.
Absolutely. Well, and they'll put in the time for it, because it's like the same way that the less privileged people in America have become our best athletes. because they're not comfortable enough. They're not comfortable enough to do something else. So they'll put in that extra time because they don't have mommy taking them to the shopping center.
Exactly.
That's been the history of sports always.
With rare exceptions, I think nowadays in some sports you're seeing more of a young people are becoming the products of having had all the advantages like great coaching. Baseball's going that way.
Right. For baseball players, almost like privileged tennis players, right? They've got hitting coaches and pitching coaches and fielding coaches, and that's
right.
True. But you know, the vast majority, like for example, in the history of American tennis, will show you that most of the great American tennis players come from middle class to lower class backgrounds.
Yeah, and yet that's not where we're looking, is it?
Well, we don't look.
There.
It doesn't. See, this is the thing. We don't look. When we top down it and we think we can look and find, it doesn't work that way. It has to do with how we create the culture that allows the sport to thus exist in it. Several nations, such as China now, thanks to Lina, and Sweden in the wake of Borg, they had an iconic player who triggered a grassroots popularity in tennis. That was different than some guy in Sweden in an office building saying, Borg's really good. Let's go find the next Borg. Let's put on a sports camp and see who has alleged talent to do that. That's different. You know, we don't look. Okay, go look. What are we going to go look? I mean, I did a story on a program in East Oakland. The guy thought he was going to look and find. No, what you have to do is create means. You have to create, okay, how do we get tennis in the PE agenda in lots of schools so the kids can at least sample it? How do we make tournaments close and affordable? And you can't necessarily make something cool. We had four great players in the 90s, and the popularity went down during those years. So it's not always clear what makes tennis cool.
Yeah, I think another interesting thing that this points out is that we get stuck examining our navel a little too much. I think we overanalyze, and we look for what's wrong, and we spend all our energy on that instead of actually going and creating new programs and introducing larger numbers of kids to the game so that then they can emerge.
And also more acting local. You know, one of my favorite examples of that is Luke Jensen at Syracuse. He's been the women's coach there for 7-plus years. He does things with his players that has them build their skills. For example, it's mandatory to serve in volley and doubles, and these are women's players, and he's having them grow their skill sets, and he's acting local. He's acting local, and I think that's the real key is for people who've had positions of significance to the game, who have some knowledge, is to really get their hands around the dirt and not think, oh, I'm going to have a player and she's going to be great. Just I'm going to help people learn to be better players. I'm going to work on make them a better player.
Well, and then also the other thing culturally that I agree with what you're saying, and I think culturally another thing that we've lost is that desire for the sport to be an avenue to create discipline in the person, whatever the outcome, no matter whether the person's going to be a D1 or a pro player or not, but
right.
Just that this is a sport, and you bring a certain level of discipline to the working on your skills. And, yeah, it should be fun, but you don't go there just to have fun. I mean, I would like to say that fun is a byproduct of the work.
I agree with you. I think that's a great way to think of it.
But, you know, I see a lot of kids and programs and parents where the program has bent to the will of the parents and kids who are coming only for fun.
Well, sure, because it's a consumer-based activity, and the parent doesn't know any better, and the parent doesn't understand what the skill the kids should be learning is. Maybe the parent has read a little bit to know about mechanics and technique and thinks, oh, good, the kid should be learning how to turn his shoulder and hit the tar out of a forehand, but the parent doesn't understand the rich literature of the game. The parent might have studied a little rudimentary composition, but the parents and the coach isn't going to do that when you're doing mass groups of lessons that are monetized so that the the mini academy can make as much money as possible. You know, I hear about kids pay these kids and their families, pay these pros $30 to $50 a day so they can arrange, you know, mini practice matches for them at their quasi academy. That's not learning. That's an after school. That's what you and I used to call a public park.
Right. Well, yeah.
They're not learning. They're not engaged in learning and skill building. And because skill building in tennis, this sport isn't soccer. This is like learning to play the piano. You know, this sport is, this is skill. This is, you know, takes a lot of technique to learn something as simple as how to serve well. It's how to change it to a spin serve.
Okay, so let me throw you, because you said something that spurred me on, because I have this theory that part of it is that there was a day when adults came to the club and they played until noon, and then when they left, then the kids came and played for 5 or 6 hours on Saturday or Sunday afternoon. What happened to that? Where did that go?
Well, first of all, the adults on weekends could play as much as they wanted. I think what happened is that kids don't hang out at places anymore because they have much more organized activities. Public institutions disintegrated, let's say in California, in the wake of Proposition 13, whether they're public schools, public parks, fears of crime. You know, kids don't just hang out at a park or a club like that. And then if they do, like I used to do that when I was a kid, I'd hang out at a park, I'd play with the adults, I'd play with kids, I'd hang out there all day, I'd go to lunch, whatever. You know, some places they have a swimming pool, et cetera. And I think now the parent is focused on outcome. The parent doesn't want the child to lose, so the kid isn't as motivated. You know, the tennis has kind of become vocationalized. You know, it was kind of a process of an activity before, and now it's kind of a mini vocation where the parent, oh, is my kid going to be good enough to get a scholarship? What's going on here? And they start to want to channel towards results instead of just the sheer process of playing. Kids play way fewer practice matches than they used to. They don't play practice matches as much, so they're not problem solving. They go out and they hit with each other, but they're not really learning something the way they would if they played two sets with each other. And so,
yeah,
so that kind of...
Yeah, let me go off on that for a second, because one thing that I try to indoctrinate my players in, but I'm not sure how much buy-in I get, is that if we're going to learn a new technique, okay, good, we teach it to you, then we drill it, then we're going to play a point situation and see if you maintain your technique integrity. Then
right.
You need to play a practice match and have it be monitored somewhat and see if you're maintaining your stroke integrity during that situation, in a quasi-competitive situation. Then you can use it in a match. But what
well,
I
but all,
see,
either way, you could be doing all at once. I mean, you do it in the monitor one, you should be doing homework. You know, Bill teaches me the better way to, you know, hit a forehand volley, and then I drill on it with him, and then I should go putting this to work. I should be calling my buddy Steve and play a practice match with him.
Well, yeah,
do they
but what
do that?
I think do what I think what people do is they go take a private lesson with their coach and they work on said stroke, even though it might not resemble the real situation that they deal with when they play another kid, and then they go to their match thinking, okay, now I've got the silver bullet, and all the intervening steps haven't happened, so it doesn't happen, and then now blame has to be assigned. I guess,
and then they get, then they fire, and then they say, the, and the mom says, oh, he lost, the coach isn't any good. And so let's get another coach. Let's go to another environment. Because there's homework, because these things are hard. Because it's hard. It's hard to learn how to be a good tennis. It's hard to learn how to be a bad tennis player. It takes effort in this sport just to not stink. I mean, you and I, I'm just a plausible 4-5, and that's taken me 40 years to be that bad, that good. I mean,
yeah,
that's
exactly.
A, you know, I mean, and that takes an effort. But people, you know, to pay a little bit of a price, you know. But kids, they don't play as many practice matches. They hit with each other. They go to these kind of stylized, you know, quasi workouts with other players, and they drill and they hit and that's not problem solving. That's not playing practice sets, and practice sets, that's how you learn how to play. You know,
I have a fun story to tell you, and then you can give me your comments after you get done. All right. So I was at a high school match, and the number one player for each team is a top 20 player in NorCal. And the gal who's number 20 is playing for the team that I'm helping out for the day, and she's facing number 17, right?
Okay.
So I'm watching this match, and early, probably mid-first set, I realized that 90% of the time, number 20 loops a ball up high and deep to number 17. Number 17 then responds with a short ball that lands in front of the service line.
Good.
So, that's enough of a nugget where you can win a match in straight sets, no?
Right.
Okay, so I'm thinking, if you know how to play tennis and you know how to cause the other player to hit a short ball almost guaranteed, you ought to be in control of the match. So
right.
We convey the information to this kid ranked number 20, and I think she also had a pretty good national ranking as well.
Ooh.
And her response, her response to the coach who actually said it was, "Oh no, I just need to be more consistent." Right?
Yep.
How old is this girl?
16?
No, they're 18, 17, 18.
18. Yeah, they were sold out when they were 13. No one taught them how to volley when they were 13. I could name you pro players who they're just worse versions of.
Okay, well, anyway, so the story gets better. Story gets better. So what does she do? She then goes and really works on playing very consistently while feeding this girl balls just beautifully into her strike zone where number 17 can now pummel the ball. And loses the first set 6-4.
Mm-hmm.
So then you lost the set. Now are you going to listen? Do not hit with this gal, and give her balls waist to shoulder high because she's going to kill you. Instead, please loop the ball above her shoulder, get the short ball, and then you can do whatever you want.
Then what you could do, what you should do, which is come to net off the easy short ball you've elicited. You did the hard work. Now all you have to do is the easy work. However, you know why she didn't do that? There are two reasons why she didn't do that. She wasn't taught how to properly volley and hit an overhead, so she's afraid of doing that. And number two,
right.
And this is a very interesting thing that I think emerged in the game, I think when the game became a little more baseline-oriented, the emphasis became became a little less on the awareness of the opponents, a little bit more self-oriented. So as long as I'm hitting my shot, and that's fine as long as your shot is better anyway. And so it became this kind of big forehand, my shot. When you come to net, it's a lot more inherently interactive. When I'm coming to net and playing all-court tennis, I got to be aware of the fact that my opponent can hit a down-the-line backhand or they got a cross-court forehand or this or that. And so at that, and the real deal tennis is, and you were aware of this when you saw that tactical pattern going on, it's not an individual sport. It's a relationship sport. It's two people interacting, looking to mess each other up. And that girl was given the advice that says, here's the ticket. Here's the way you mess the person up so you can do what you want to do. And she, for lack of skill and will, didn't do it. And I will say, so she's an 18-year-old fractions player.
She was a star pupil of an academy that likes to call itself one of the top ones around.
Hey, no, look, they're getting all this outcome. Our players are ranked. Our players are getting scholarships. A girl who plays that kind of game, the kind of don't miss tennis by the age of 13, who's ranked in the top 30 of the section, if she can maintain cruising altitude by the time she's 17, she'll probably have 5 scholarship offers. Never mind that her improvement path is minimal. I know a girl, for example, who played sort of a kind of a moonballing, grinding game, went on to a D3 school, played one there, won a lot of matches based on a kind of moonballing style, and by the time she was 24, she said to me in a French, she goes, God, tennis is boring to me. I wish, you know, and we play doubles sometimes. I wish I knew more about how to volley, and you guys can vary paces, because she has good reflexes. She's sort of comfortable in that. And we said, well, you'd have to take 6 months and retool your grips, your concept of the game. And
right.
See, to her, her brain is smarter. She's a very bright liberal arts graduate. And yet to her, what's tennis? Tennis is kind of like running aerobics class with a racket in her hands. Sold out. She's not that big. So when she was 13, her coach said, oh, some guy who probably played a little college tennis, oh, she's not athletic. So I'll just issue her the stock order steady game. You know,
right.
You think he taught her how to volley? You think he taught her a good grip? You thought he taught her even how to stand to volley? God, some of these kids, they can't even feed lobs.
Yeah. You know, one thing I'm very happy about is I have a kid that I work with a lot, and I call him Player Z, and I blog about him a little bit. I talk about his development. And on day one, he let me switch his almost Western grip to more of a modified Eastern, almost semi-Western, so that he could drive his forehand more. He let me do that. And then,
right.
And then he initiated and said, I want to learn how to serve and volley. And now we're on this path of teaching him the complete game. And today I was talking to him that, look, the way I'm teaching you right now, you're going to take your licks in the 14s and the 16s, but when you're 18, you're going to beat everybody. Because
well,
you're going to have...
Maybe you won't, but at least you'll know how
maybe
to play.
You won't. You know, you got to sell the dream, you know.
Why,
but
no.
He's
going to... The dream is attempting to be a better tennis player. That's the dream. The dream doesn't have to be outcome-based. Why should it be... Because what happens if he loses to two people? Then now he feels like he's failed. He's a winner. He's a winner because he's already asking you to help him be better.
Okay,
you know?
You win. No, that was a good argument, and you win that one.
I'm not a loser because I became a physics grad student and didn't win the Nobel Prize. I'm a winner because I went after a PhD in physics. Just like
exactly.
You, just like you know, I think someone like you. You're if there are 100 people like you in the game, there'd be a lot. It would be in a lot better hands.
Oh man!
People like you,
that's...
acting local, got your hands around the game, working with high school players, working with juniors. That's what it's about.
Well, I would just say, let's project that out because I mean I appreciate that. I think that's really nice. But hey, coaches who are listening to this, you know, if you really believe in teaching the entire sport of tennis. Be empowered to keep doing that and reach more people, influence more people to teach the complete game.
Absolutely. Teach the broadest literature of the game and stand up to parents. And when the parent says, oh, he's not doing as well, you got to say, how do we define winning? What's the definition of winning?
It's the process. You know, one thing that the cornerstone of the philosophy of my coaching is partly stolen from Jim Lehrer, but also from a guy who's a sports psychologist at Indiana University, or he was, Dr. Gary Sale. But we, with my teams that I coach and with my players, we talk about four things. These are your goals. Goal number one, give 100% effort. Because if you give your best effort and the other guy doesn't, then your chances of winning just went way up. And you even see that on the pro tour. Guys who
absolutely
don't...
Absolutely true. Great. Well, plus it's a goal you can control.
Right.
You know, you can't control winning, but you can sure control effort. That's fantastic. Great goal. Let's hear number two.
That's why Lehrer calls it realistic goals, because it's within your control. And then number two is enjoy the competition. And
good.
In general, with boys, I have to focus more on the enjoyment. And with girls, it's more about the competition. But, you know, there are always boys that don't that have a hard time being serious, and there are girls that have a hard time lightening up, you know. But
yep,
competition,
good.
Show yourself strong and wise, and finally learn from every circumstance, win or loss, you know. So there's your process. Mm-hmm. And there have been times that my team has won the match but failed in those three or four things. And I told them, yeah, you might have won, but this felt like a loss today.
Mm-hmm.
To achieve those goals. So let's shift gears here. Let's get back. I just want to make sure, did we really cover the whole topic of how coaches and parents sell out their players?
Of course not. We could go on for hours and years about this. I think it's kind of a shame. It's kind of the whole nature of, you know, parents paying money and parents looking for coaches, and there'll always be another coach who'll come up with another idea to undermine one other coach and say that their approach is different. You know, it's just kind of, you know, it's a tough little business out there, and their academy is the one because we've got good players and all this kind of, you know, all that kind of language, and so it's competitive. I think, you know, and coaches, actually I would say instructors. I don't know. There are instructors and there are coaches, and I think a lot of it has to do with the way the very teaching model, I think, is broken. I think a lot of teachers are mostly good at stroke production, and I don't think they understand how to engage with tactics and how you really help a player craft a playing style. I mean, you know, they feed balls, they hit them kind of user-friendly, they even do, I know there are these game situations now, but do they really, like, for example, how many instructors watch their students play matches with peers and really can study that? You know, that's an art form, and at heart, the model is still the hour-long private lesson, the guy gets his hopper, feeds you some pretty friendly balls, and, you know, I've thought of that myself when I've gone on trips and taken a lesson with a hotel teaching pro, and I'm thinking, I don't want any input from this guy. You've never seen me compete. You've never seen me choke. You've never seen me win. You've never seen me play a 3-all, 15, 30 points. What do you know about what kind of tennis player? Oh, you've seen how I turn my shoulders when you're hitting the ball out of a bucket?
Right, right.
And all you're going to see is what I am, is a middle-class tennis player?
Yes. So a couple of years ago, Dr. Bob Love came out to the USPTA convention at Stanford, and we're in a lecture hall, and there's 150 pros there. And he says, hey, raise your hand if you're a coach, right? And 150 hands go up. And he says, no, you're not. Now, keep your hand up if you've seen every one of your players play a match in the last month. Keep your hand up. Oh, not a lot. And they said, no, everybody put your hand down if you didn't do that. You're a teacher. These people are coaches. And I was like, and I thought, wow, that was great.
You know, that's fantastic.
And, you know, so he gave everybody what for right there. And hopefully a lot of people changed their minds about the way they approach it.
Well, it's all this way that people want to, you know, look, you know, there used to be facilities and instructors, and now there are academies and coaches, and my kid's got a coach, and look, the term coaching is used. You know, it used to be people would see consultants. Now they have, you know, they have life coaches, and the whole, you know, coaching's been kind of an upgraded enter the lexicon word, right?
Yeah. Well, I had Steve Chandler, one of the great life coaches on planet Earth, on my show, so that's why I'm, like, chuckling, because
he ranked?
Really is fantastic, and, you know, you might want to look into having one. It might help you.
What's he's one of the great life coaches? Do we know what he's ranked? Did he win a tournament? Did he win the tournament? Who did he beat in the semis? I bet he's good, though. You know, it's like, that's the thing about it. It's like...
Of the life coaching Grand Slam tournament recently at the championship.
I like that.
It's Wimbledon, which is, I learned that recently. That's the real name of that tournament, is the championship to Wimbledon. So I've decided to only call it that. Okay, so let's go. We've got about a little more than 10 minutes left here. So what are some of the cornerstones of tennis education as you see it?
For whom?
That's great. Let's break it into three groups. We'll go coaches, we'll go parents first, players, then coaches. So what are your cornerstones of tennis education for parents? What are the
The parent needs to understand that it's a process and an activity, and the parent needs to rid themselves of an outcome expectation. And the parent needs to understand that losing and winning, that actually the kid is a winner just for playing, and that results will be results, and let it be. And get out of the results business. What's the second group? Coaches?
Is that all parents?
I want to hold off on parents for now because I think the other groups are, I want to make sure they get their due love and then we'll circle back. Because, you know, I think parents are.
One each. Don't go for seconds until everybody's at first. So let's go on to coaches then.
Coaches should understand that their business is not data transfer, but engagement. And coaches need to understand that they need to understand who their player is as a human being and as a student before they just transfer data to them about how to hit tennis balls. Knowing how to hit tennis balls is a very limited, a very narrow part of what the game is. And what coaches need to do is understand how to really teach a student. You know, to me, a great coach is someone who has five players who all play differently. Not issued out. Oh, this is the John Smith way of how I teach, and the coach and the good coaches I know, they understand. They channel into the athletic and tennis engagement of their student and how they work. That's what a great coach does.
Yeah, I fully agree with that because I think that people need to understand that they need to play like themselves.
But what the good coach does. What a good coach does is help them gain an awareness of themselves that, hey, this kind of works for you. You know, for example, I'm 5'8", and I had some lessons, but not that many lessons, and I don't appear to be necessarily the next Bo Jackson, and yet I serve in volley, I come to net, and I shudder to think if some teacher had gotten a hold of me at a certain age, he might have said, you're not that big, you don't appear that athletic, we're going to teach you to be really steady. Without any understanding of my makeup, of my tolerance for, let's say, being passed, of my understanding of how to initiate a point, all sorts of things, right?
Yeah.
And so it's really important for the coach to understand how their player, you know, conceives things, how their player is a student in school, what type of topics they like, many things. So a good coach, like for example, I think one of the things that's great about you is that you're always expanding your mind across many disciplines and then bringing that back to your tennis.
Well, now I have a hard time getting my mind out of doors.
Out of what?
Gotcha. Okay, so let's go on to players. What are the cornerstones of that they need to, the cornerstones of education for a player? So this, and you know what I'd like to do? Why don't you speak to a player who's going to take responsibility for building their own game and start telling the coaches and the parents what they want.
Well, but they may not always know. So I think it really has to be based on relentless curiosity about how the game works and trial and error and most of all a willingness to, you're right, take responsibility. For example, one thing I do when I play junior players when I meet the parent or the kid, I say to the parent, the parent can call me the first time to play, but I don't want to take a call from the kid the second time. I want the kid to call me. I don't want the parent to call me and say, hi, will you play with my Johnny? I won't take that phone call. Will not. And I want the kid to take responsibility for their tennis destiny. And then the kid can try things, can look at things and have curiosity. You know, they show up to a lesson, hey, what's this slice backhand? What's that? What's a kick serve? And that's not saying give me one of those because a good teacher will say to a student, well, why do you want that? And instead of just giving it to them, and, oh, here's why you might want that. And they build it, they work on it together. Ooh, I'm not a good teacher. I don't really understand the kick serve. So maybe you ought to contact this other guy and he'll teach it to you. So
the player
needs to have a relentless curiosity. A desire to constantly learn things about the tennis, whether they're watching, whether they're reading, whether they're talking to people, a constant engagement in the sport beyond just their results and a willingness to experiment, to try things, to learn.
Okay. Wow. So do you have more? Do you have anything more for parents now?
Yeah, that's right. You're right. I love what you said. No seconds, let me just head first. I think the parent, for example, I'm always on the lookout for parents who use the word we or who start wearing the same warm-up suit as the kid. The parent has to get their ego out of it. The parent has to understand what occurs with matches and not automatically side with the kid. The parent has to learn proper language. So when the kid loses to a certain kind of player, the parent does not say, oh, that's just a pusher. You'll beat him next time. The parent needs to learn to build a healthy respect for everybody who can play the game in all sorts of ways.
That's
and
a great
really
point. So, Joel, you know what? That really is a great point because I don't know how many times I traveled with my son to tournaments and whatnot, and he might have played a fantastic match, and then the parent of the other kid will tell me, your son played great. And then I'm like, wait, no, hold on. He's right here. Tell him.
That's good.
You know, I didn't hit a ball. All I did was drive, you know.
Drive. You're right. I think the parent needs to, but the parents really need to let the kids learn their tennis. You know, I'm not quite sure what to make, whether parents should be at the lesson or not at the lesson. I don't know what to make of it. There's part of me that thinks, you know, the parents shouldn't even be at the lesson. Leave the kid alone.
You know, well, one thing, I think Stan Smith said some stuff about this, about how a parent should be at the matches like 50 to 75% of the time, and that they should probably be at practice less than 50% of the time. You know, with this current situation I have, I really like it because the parents love and support the kid and will do anything within reason for their kid. And they communicate fantastically with me, and I let them know what's going on with him, you know, in terms of his development. And then I'm sure they talk, and they tell me, no, our you know, player Z definitely tells us what he's thinking. And we just have this nice little synergy going. And, you know, it's really a great thing because they our initial meeting that I had with them, we sat down and I said, hey, look, here's where he is, here's where you want him to go, and here's the path it might take. There might be some really big ups. There might be a really long plateau. There could be some downs. You know, if there's a lengthy plateau, that's him adjusting to his new level. It doesn't mean he's not improving. You know, so I gave them the whole rundown about all the reasons why they shouldn't fire me in 6 months. And they really accepted that. So, I mean, I think that's pretty fair. So I think you give great advice that parents should take a much more long-term approach to their players' development. What do you think about this? I like the idea of the parents hiring a, quote, head coach, main coach, but then allowing the player to go to different camps and whatnot, but to have that one coach who kind of helps disseminate information.
Well, I guess it all depends on how many resources. I think that can be a good idea. I guess it depends on how many sources they have. You know, I mean, it's like when we're talking about economic things, I mean, I don't know, you mean like the main dissertation advisor and the other faculty? I don't know, it depends. That's kind of what Pete Sampras had. Of course, that's pretty expensive. You know, at heart, another way, I think, a lot of kids can learn to play. You take two or three lessons a month, and you get on with your game. In other words, I think here's something for coaches. To be the willingness to say to a kid, for every hour I spend with you, you need to spend 2 to 3 putting in time into your tennis. You, the kid. You know, not, so I don't want, okay, good. Go take your weekly lesson. Go take your weekly lesson and work on your game. Go do your homework. Go do your homework.
Yeah.
Go do your drills. Go play your practice sets. Go play your thing. The coach is not the center because at a certain point, it's a little bit what I think of when I hear the whole term about mentoring. It's a little bit of an abdication of responsibility. Oh, I have a coach. I have a mentor. You know what? Nobody has. Forget that. You're in charge. Because in a way, and I forgot to say this at the beginning, at one level, I believe no one ever developed a player. No one. There's only one person who ever develops a player, and that's the player. Because they're the ones who put in the hard work.
Right there. That was it. That was the statement of all statements from this time here. So, Joel, thanks so much for coming on the show. We have about 2 minutes. I gotta get you to give us your, if you want to give out some contact information so people can reach you.
No, they find me on the internet. It's okay, Joel Drucker. You'll find me on the internet. And great being on your show, Bill. You're doing a great job, and I look forward to doing it again.
You're too kind, and have a great day. Thanks again, and have a good one.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network.
Participants
are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.
This segment is brought to you by Pocket Radar, and we're here talking with Ken DeHart, and he's going to explain a little bit about how he uses the Pocket Radar to enhance the learning of his students. Ken?
Bill, the Pocket Radar has been like the easiest radar gun I've ever had to use. Had radar guns where they've had a thing set at the net with measure speed, and we hit that and break it a few times, pointing a radar gun, and the batteries would go dead. With the Pocket Radar, it's about the size of a cell phone, and it's so easy to use. You just point it, you press the red button, and it records it. And it's simple because I can have the kids use it instead of me having to use it all the time, which allows me to be free to roam around and do other things with it. And it's so simple to read. In fact, it'll measure how fast someone is running as well as how fast they're hitting a ball. And we do it not only for the serve, but we can actually measure ground stroke speed and volley speeds. So what we tend to do a lot in my classes, we'll say, look, we're hitting at level two. Level two for you should be a 45-mile-an-hour ground stroke. Or level three should be like a 65-mile-an-hour ground stroke. We actually talk to the kids about the speed they actually hit the ball at and measure that speed, so when they hit it, they get a feel for how fast they should swing racket-head speed-wise. They start to understand what they're doing with the ball better, too, by measuring the speed of the ball. Pretty much, you know, if you'd stand behind the server and aim it at the spot where you see the ball's going to come out of like that again, it works. There's not, you know, you can be a little bit off-center. You don't have to be right on it. You can also measure the serve from a little bit more from the front. Same with the ground strokes, you can measure them from head-on or from behind. It's what's really neat about this, it doesn't have to be an exact science like it used to be with the old radar guns. You had to get it right, and usually you got the racket head speed and not the ball speed. Pocket Radar doesn't have it at all, and it's got a great long-life battery operation. It doesn't require recharging and resetting all the time either, which is great for us because usually we got to pick it up and use it, and, oh, I forgot to charge it. And it's not like that with the Pocket Radar. People get deceived. Like, a lot of our juniors think they're serving at 100, 120 miles an hour. And they see it like 60 miles an hour? I said, right. Now, if you want to increase your speed, you have to learn to relax more. Because the looser you are, the faster you can increase racket head speed. And we can tell when they start to tense up because they actually lose speed. So, you know, you're saying you're getting too tight. Well, what does it mean to the student? Well, if I measure it, your ball speed has gone down. As you start to loosen up again, you'll see you'll increase your ball speed. So it's an easy way to help them understand tension as far as related to speed and more of a natural athletic motion. So most people try to tense up to hit harder. And we know when you're too tight, you're too tense. When you're too tense, you're done. You're past history. You got to stay loose to play well.
Thanks for coming on, Ken, to talk about the Pocket Radar. And for those of you who are interested in this, you can send an email to info@pocketradar.com, or you can get more information on the internet at pocketradar.com. And then also, if you're a U.S. customer, you can call in at 1-888-381-2672. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, so August 10th, we're going to be giving away a pocket radar. And the first thing that you need to do to become eligible is you need to either send an email to me at schooloftennis@gmail.com, or the easier way to go about this would be to follow School of Tennis on Twitter, as well as the UR Tennis Network, UR Tennis on Twitter, as well as Pocket Radar. So those people that do one of those two things are going to be able to be eligible to win. And then what I'd like you to also do is be ready to answer a question, and that would be, what were two negative aspects of using a standard radar gun that Ken had described? Because those negatives have been answered with the pocket radar. All right? So thanks so much for tuning in. Continue to listen to all the UR Tennis Network shows. I very much appreciate everyone who continues to listen to past episodes. And please tweet, share, like, email, all that stuff. We want your voice to be heard. We want you to hear divergent voices in the world of tennis, because it really truly is your sport of a lifetime, and we want to grow that and empower you. All right? So thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week.